Tous. Malheureusement, Wilson donc n'a pas pu venir suite à un problème médical. Nous avons donc remplacé cette rencontre avec la rencontre d'un auteur qui se fait malheureusement un peu rare en France, Walter John Williams, qu'on a la chance donc d'accueillir. On accueille aussi donc le directeur de collection de la dentelle du cygne aux éditions La Talente, Alain Katnik, qui se fait aussi extrêmement rare en public. Donc je suis assez fier de vous les présenter tous les deux. John Walter Williams, vous
Yes, I'd like to apologize for not being Robert Charles Wilson or even Robert Anton Wilson, but I do have three names, so I hope I'll be an adequate substitute.
Merci beaucoup. Donc, vous êtes né en 1953 aux États-Unis, mais vous êtes d'origine finlandaise.
Yes, all four of my grandparents came from Finland. And the actual family name is Kuusikoski. But Americans found this very difficult to spell and pronounce, and so the name Williams was eventually adopted.
Ce qui explique donc votre blondeur.
Yes. Yes, except that if I were really Finnish, I would be very pale also. I would look more like a vampire.
Vous devriez peut-être essayer de vous lancer dans ce nouveau genre de fantasy urbaine rempli de vampires. Je suis sûr que vous feriez des choses très intéressantes.
Well, I look more like a vampire that's just eaten heavily, I think. That's
John Walter Williams, on vous connaît bien sûr pour le roman Câblé, l'un des livres le plus connu en tout cas traduit en France. Pouvez-vous nous dire comment vous êtes venu à écrire de la science-fiction? Parce que avant d'en écrire, vous aviez écrit notamment des romans maritimes.
Yes. I have always wanted to write. It's been an ambition from a very early age. Before I could actually read and write, I would dictate stories to my parents who would write them down for me. And I grew up in the space age. I remember my parents taking me outside on a very cold winter night to watch Sputnik travel over our house, and grew up with Gemini and Apollo and the landings on the moon. So it was kind of a natural context for me. And I read a lot of science fiction, but for some reason I didn't think I wanted to write it. And I started out writing historical fiction. I didn't think I was good enough to write science fiction. I had, during the 60s and 70s, I was reading the works of Roger Zelazny and Samuel R. Delaney, the whole 60s wave, and I just didn't think I was that good. And so I was trying to write practically anything else. But my career as a historical writer collapsed in the early 80s. Which was one of those sort of publishing accidents that happens. It wasn't just me who lost his career at that point. There were a number of historical writers that stopped selling all at the same time. And so I was casting about for a new career, and I was trying everything. I was trying to write mysteries. I was trying to write thrillers. I was trying to write literary fiction. And it was the science fiction that sold. All of my other attempts were rejected because they were too strange or too unusual. And this is hardly ever a criticism that happens in science fiction. So I think I finally did find my home.
Vous avez déjà écrit une vingtaine de romans. Quelque chose qui me frappe, c'est que vous ne vous cantonnez pas à un seul genre littéraire ou un seul sous-genre. Vous avez bien sûr écrit Câblé. Qui est un roman de cyberpunk, Hardwired. Vous avez fait aussi du space opera avec Aristoi, du thriller environnemental avec notamment un livre qui s'appelle The Rift, ou bien sûr, on l'a dit tout à l'heure, du roman historique. Pourquoi vous variez-vous autant votre écriture, autant les genres?
I think also the experience of having written five historical novels all having to do with the sea, had a lot to do with that decision. I wrote 5 books that it revolved entirely around several hundred men on a ship. And the monotony of it grew considerable by the end of this period. And so once I became a science fiction writer, I looked at the vast field of science fiction and I realized that this was an enormous terrain that I could help to map. And so I deliberately set out to explore as many alleys in science fiction as I possibly could.
D'accord.
Il me semble qu'en ce moment, vous commencez à écrire plus de séries ou de livres qui sont dans le même univers. Mm-hmm. Est-ce que c'est une décision qui est dictée par des raisons commerciales ou est-ce que c'est vous-même qui avez décidé de rester dans une même veine pendant quelques temps ? Je pense à la confrérie des immortels, par exemple.
Yes. I decided to do an epic story, and that would require more than a single volume. Originally, that series was projected to run to 9 or 12 books, and it only it ended after the third book in the States. Although it is a complete story. If you can find those books here, you can read them, and it will be a complete reading experience. But I decided to just tackle something really epic. And also the fact that before that I had written a number of very large books. And the aspect of taking one very large book and breaking it into multiple volumes and being paid for each one of those volumes suddenly seemed very attractive financially. That instead of writing one big book and being paid so much, I could write 3 books and be paid 3 times as much. Unfortunately, every time I've tried to write a series, publishing changes around me. And this began with my first publication of the historical novels, that during that time, the market changed, the publishers changed, all of the names changed. And this has happened with just about every series I've attempted. With Le Mélancolie des Immortels had 6 editors on the one book before the book was ever in print, and so there was a kind of rupture at the publishing house between the person who acquired the stories in the first place and the people who ended up actually being my editors.
Personne ne se sent plus concerné dans des conditions pareilles.
Well, I was concerned by it, but
je vous oubliais.
I may have been the only person. Yeah. Publishing in the United States is going through quite a bit of strain right now, and has been for the last 10 years. And there are very few actual American publishers anymore. I think there's only one large American publisher left. And then the other American publishers are either owned by German or British or French publishers. Right now I'm being published by Hachette in both Britain and the United States.
Vous n'avez pas peur que de brouiller un peu les cartes et de perdre un peu votre public en changeant ainsi de genre?
I seem to have found a steady audience that enjoys finding something new with each book. It's not an enormous audience, but it's a very loyal audience, and I'm very glad that I've acquired them.
Oui. Vous êtes souvent associé ou catalogué comme écrivain et auteur de cyberpunk, notamment avec Cablé. Quel regard portez-vous sur ce sous-genre 20 ans après?
Well, the name came after the work. I had just finished Cablé and I sent it to my editor. And my editor called me and said, well, you realize now they're going to call you a cyberpunk. And I said, what's that? Is that good? So the labels come afterwards. And I was never very easy I was never very happy with the idea of being labeled in the first place. And so my initial impulse was to go off and write something very different. But I think cyberpunk was a great liberation for me. It enabled me to write about a number of things that I'd been concerned about. In the early 80s, firstly, we had a very conservative government in the States under Ronald Reagan, and I think he's single-handedly responsible for cyberpunk. I think all of cyberpunk is a reaction to the presidency of Ronald Reagan. But at that point, you began to see enormous worldwide media campaigns on behalf of commercial and political interests, and that was just getting rolling, and you could see that starting to happen, and you could see it cyberspace starting to be created, and see the possibilities in that. It was very interesting to explore all of that territory. And a few years ago, Kablai was republished in the United States, and I had a chance to read it again for the first time in 20 years. One of the things that surprised me was that the things that were supposed to be shocking in that book are now part of ordinary reality. Yes. You know, we have, in the States anyway, we have drugs being sold on television to a mass audience. We have the replacement of national armies with mercenaries. The United States has more mercenaries in Iraq than it ever had regular soldiers. There's a continuing overlap between commercial interests and political interests. So many of the bad things have come true, and in a way I kind of resent, I'm sad that I proved to be such a good prophet with that particular book.
Ce qui malheureusement était un peu le cas. Autre chose qui me paraît assez frappant dans vos œuvres, c'est l'influence qu'ont notamment les jeux de rôle. Sur votre style littéraire, vous avez un style qui est très fluide, avec des rebondissements assez récurrents et de retournements de situation assez intéressantes. Est-ce que c'est quelque chose qui vous influence beaucoup ? Parce que je sais que vous êtes un grand joueur de jeux de rôle.
Yes, I've been doing role-playing games for years and years. I think the gaming approach helps me to visualize certain situations well. I don't necessarily set out to game my books, but that experience allows me to create scenarios that I can play out in my head, and it might contribute to my style being a little clearer to the reader. The most obvious overlap is my new book, This Is Not a Game, which will be published here by L'Atlante in February. It was influenced, I was actually hired to write a game, be a staff writer on a game called Last Call Poker. And Last Call Poker was an alternate reality game. And for those of you who are not familiar with that, they're very unique in that alternate reality games enter your real life. If you join an online game, such as World of Warcraft, you go to your computer, you enter the online world, you have adventures in that world, and then you leave, and it's over. With an alternate reality game, once you enter that world, the game pursues you into real life. You start getting telephone calls from fictional characters. They send you faxes. They send you emails. You are sent out into missions in the real world in order to accomplish things on behalf of the characters in the game. It can overlap reality in surprising ways. There was an alternate reality game that was used to promote the film The Dark Knight, the last Batman movie, and there's a character in that film called Harvey Dent, who was running for district attorney, and so the game company had Harvey Dent for district attorney rallies all throughout the country, which were continually being interrupted by the Joker, and mayhem would ensue, and the players would get involved in all of this. Well, unfortunately, they decided to do this in Chicago, which is run by a very strict political machine, and the Chicago police saw these people having a rally for a political figure that was clearly not one of their own, and so the whole crew was arrested and thrown into jail for disturbing the peace. And I think that was an overlap with reality that they didn't quite intend. But in This Is Not a Game, I try a direct overlap of the gaming reality with reality in our world. And the main character, Dagmar, uses alternate reality gaming techniques in order to solve a crisis in our world.
Alain Katnick, donc vous êtes directeur de la collection La Dentelle du Cygne aux éditions La Talente. Donc vous avez vivement recommandé de traduire et de sortir cet ouvrage qui sortira donc en février. Pouvez-vous nous en parler tout petit peu plus?
Eh bien, Walter en a déjà beaucoup dévoilé une grande partie. Ce que je pourrais rajouter. En dehors de la technique pure des jeux en réalité alternée, c'est que c'est moi qui suis également un joueur de jeux de rôle, c'est que ce livre nous parle d'une amitié entre quatre personnes et qui a du mal à survivre au passage des années. Et c'est une histoire de vengeance, mais qui est d'autant plus poignante. Qu'elle se déroule entre quatre personnes qui ont été extraordinairement proches, puisque à l'université, ils ont joué des années et des années à des jeux de rôle ensemble. Et c'est un point qui, comme les histoires qui font intervenir la famille, en font des livres très forts et qui peuvent bien vous prendre aux tripes.
Voilà. John Walter.
This is another book in which I proved to be a successful prophet. The book came out, and elements of the book involve the crash of financial markets, and also the collapse of a government in a Southeast Asian country. And within 2 months of the book being released, both these things occurred in the real world, and. I was very happy that these events at least waited until the book was in print, so that it was clear that I had created these events and not the other way around.
Je pense que c'est une malédiction puisque le Walter vient de terminer le second livre dans cet univers, en tout cas avec le même personnage principal, et je pense qu'il va pouvoir nous expliquer qu'il lui est arrivé une mésaventure un peu similaire.
Yes. In this case, reality didn't wait for me to finish my novel. There's an element of the novel that involves a revolution in a Middle Eastern country that is created and supported by social media. And I was in the middle of writing this, and the Iranian Revolution happened. Not only did the revolution take a similar form, but It looked as if the Iranian revolutionaries were stealing scenes from my book. It was as if they had access to it. So I had to do a considerable rewrite on that section of the book because the idea wasn't as bright and shiny as new as it had been before last July. So it's now much shinier and much cooler than it was. I had to strain myself to come up with a lot more cool ideas.
Quelque chose qui me semble très important pour vous, c'est la réalité. La réalité. J'ai l'impression que votre écriture a besoin de nourriture, donc de vivre.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Vivre pour écrire. C'est un peu votre fer de lance.
Une devise. Hein.
Well, I try to seek experience. I travel a good deal. I have hobbies that require me to undergo new experiences. I do martial arts. I do scuba diving. I travel a lot. I'm always seeking new material. I have a prejudice against what I think of as geek fiction, which is the sort of fiction that is written by somebody who spends his entire life staring at a screen, and who gets his or her entire life experience vicariously that way. And I know writers like that, and though they can be very talented, you can always tell that this isn't based on something that they've had firsthand experience with. And even though, you know, I am a science fiction writer, and I naturally write about many things that I don't have personal experience with, I always try and anchor it in some kind of reality in order to make it live for the reader and for myself.
J'ai entendu dire que vous n'aviez pas d'autre métier, vous ne faisiez qu'écrire.
I've been a full-time writer for 30 years. I had my 30th anniversary back in January. And it seems a long time.
Vous écrivez aussi, donc on a parlé un tout petit peu du jeu vidéo, mais j'ai appris récemment que vous aviez aussi fait des jeux vidéo de sport. Quelque chose qui est assez surprenant.
Not sports game. Actually, it was a science fiction game. Spore. Spore. The title of the game was Spore, S-P-O-R-E, okay. From Electronic Arts, which follows the development of an entire species. At the beginning of this game, you were a single-celled animal in a single drop of water, and then gradually you evolve abilities and intelligence and develop civilization and then go out into the stars, and the game gives you an entire galaxy as a playing board. I mean, they literally create every star in this galaxy and every planet around every star in this galaxy, so it's a vast game. And I'm not responsible for any of that. What I did was I wrote the dialogue. So if you are playing this game and you encounter an alien and the alien has 8 arms and 12 sets of teeth and is looking very angry and jumping up and down and shouting at you, that's me that you're talking to.
Mais comment est-ce que cette proposition a bien pu vous arriver? Est-ce que vous recevez beaucoup de propositions étranges comme ça? On ne vous aurait pas associé au dialogue de sport.
It was pure chance. One of the people connected with that project was a friend of a friend of mine, and I knew him slightly, and we had attended a convention together in Hong Kong. And when they needed a writer for this game, my name came up, and fortunately I had the time to do it. It was a very labor-intensive piece of work. They had been working on this game for 7 years, and then realized they needed a writer. And if they had come to this realization a few years earlier, it would have been a much easier job for me. But as it was, they were committed to releasing the game in September, and I started writing in January. So I had to get it done very quickly so that the game could be first tested and then released.
Vous avez aimé écrire pour ce genre de support? Est-ce que c'est radicalement différent de l'écriture d'un roman traditionnel?
Oh, yes. This sort of game, especially, because this was basically creating all of the possible responses to the character's moves. So if you go to an alien species and you want an alliance, they can say, yes, we'll ally with you. No, we won't ally with you. No, we hate you and we're declaring war on you. Yes, we'll ally with you. We'll consider allying with you if you do us this job. All of that, and I had to create all of the characters of these various civilizations that the response would always come in character. But it meant going over these lists over and over and over again.
Je dirais que c'est plus d'un talent qui vient du jeu de rôle que de l'écriture elle-même, que de considérer toutes ces possibilités.
Yeah, it's I think it's closer to computer programming, a lot of that, yeah. because it's question and answer.
Oui, mais quand vous créez un scénario pour un jeu de rôle, vous avez également l'obligation d'essayer d'anticiper les différentes réactions de vos joueurs. C'est à ça que je faisais allusion, en fait.
Yes. Well, in the case of this particular game, the reactions were already pre-scripted. There were only a limited number. So it wasn't exactly creative. It was craft more than art. And so I just tried to do as thorough a job as I could, and create these characters and provide these answers that were consistent with these various kinds of characters.
Vous avez déjà écrit pour d'autres supports aussi, me semble-t-il. Est-ce que vous avez fait du comics?
I did some comics about 20 years ago, graphics novels that was within the Wild Cards project that was created by George R. R. Martin, which was an attempt to update the superhero genre, primarily through fiction, although there were spin-off comics that developed from that, and also games, which I didn't have anything to do with. I have written for Hollywood. I've written a number of movies, but none of them were made. That's a hazard. I had a good time and I was paid a nice fee for my writing. But unfortunately, if you work in that industry, you will find that most of your work will go for nothing. But the movies will not be made. The only audiovisual piece that I've had that's actually worked out was an episode of the television show Andromeda. Which is a science fiction TV show. I don't know if it's been shown over here. Because of the limitations of the acting ability of the guest star, it turned out that particular episode was very severely rewritten. Although I like to think that it retained my best lines.
Est-ce que vous savez, est-ce que vous pourriez nous expliquer comment vous viennent vos idées, d'où est-ce qu'elles viennent? Est-ce qu'il y a une procédure? Parce qu'il me semble avoir vu, par exemple, que pour À Valeur de Monde, le dernier livre que vous avez publié en France, pour la première fois, vous avez eu cette idée à partir d'un rêve.
Yes, I have in fact got 3 novels out of dreams. Of which À Valeur de Monde was the most complete. The entire first 3 chapters of that book came straight out of a dream. I had to do very little reconciliation. The whole story was laid out in the dream, including all of the characters and much of the dialogue. So that was a unique experience for me. That had never happened before. Cablé came from a nightmare. And the actual nightmare part was only a few seconds long, actually, and I developed the entire story from that.
Lesquels en particulier, juste par curiosité?
I think I'll leave that a secret. I don't want to spoil anything, but it probably is the most horrific piece of the book. But otherwise, in the process, I don't know where I pick up most of my ideas. They just come to me. Usually, I don't have any one idea for a book. Usually, I have a very large number of ideas, and I just start bashing them together and seeing where that will go.
Quelque chose qui me plaît particulièrement dans vos ouvrages, c'est qu'il y a de très belles images. Vous avez un style qui est très visuel, surtout dans, par exemple Cablé, À Valeur de Monde, qui est assez visuel. C'est quelque chose que vous souhaitez ou techniquement vous faites quelque chose de spécial?
Well, I think if you were writing a scenario in which your audience does not live. None of you have lived in any of my futures. So I have to be very careful to expose those futures to you in a way that you can work out, that you can understand, and visually and sensually is probably all in all the most concrete way to do this. I could give you a dry lecture, or I could paint you a picture, and I think painting the picture will give you the idea faster than the lecture will.
Une des thématiques récurrentes de votre œuvre en général, c'est la thématique de l'immortalité.
Yes, or to put it another way, one of the themes in my fiction is death. We had a panel yesterday on the subject of immortality, and I was asked by Serge, is immortality a technical problem? And what I should have said, it was one of those wisdom of the staircase moments where, as soon as I left the panel, I realized what my reply should have been. And my reply is that death is a technical problem. And that immortality is the solution. I enjoy life a lot, and I want to live it forever. And in science fiction, I can visualize ways of bringing this about. Death is one of those things that all human beings share at this point. So is tragedy. So is strife. So is loss. And I think if you're going to address anything like reality in fiction, you have to deal with all of these things or explain why they're not present. When I started writing science fiction, I decided very early on that I wanted to write a book in which everything worked out, in which the future was fairly benign, and that was Night Moves, which has not yet been in print in France. And then another story in which everything went wrong, and that was Kublai. And since then, I've returned to both of these ideas, but I am beginning to find the future in which everything is benign to be a greater challenge.
Yes.
Yeah, it's very easy to do dystopia. It's very easy to think how things can be destroyed and how things can go wrong. But to work out a scenario in which there is no death, there is no war, there is no poverty, that's a real challenge, and I enjoy this challenge a lot. That was Avalor du Monde. And of course, because this is fiction, and fiction thrives on conflict, you have to find a suitable conflict for a world in which there is no war and no death and no poverty. And that is also a challenge. But I found that in these cases, when you get a world like that, the problems just become more cosmic. In Avalor du Monde, the eventual problem is as cosmic as anything can get. I don't want to give away the last few chapters. Otherwise, I'd explicate on that a little more.
Une petite question. Quelles sont vos influences, que ce soit à l'intérieur de la science-fiction ou à l'extérieur, influences littéraires?
That's hard to say. There's so many. Just off the top of my head, I really adore Vladimir Nabokov. Vladimir Nabokov, the author of Lolita. I don't write anything like him, but I very much respond to his style and his attitude. Thomas Pynchon of Gravity's Rainbow. For social novels, Jane Austen. I think one of the kind of interesting metaphysical somebody who could combine metaphysics and adventure would be Joseph Conrad. His characters are always grappling with the fundamental nature of reality as they are doing exciting things on sailing ships. And that was a real education for me, was reading Conrad. in the field, I think the whole 60s wave. I think Zelazny, I think Delaney, I think Norman Spinrad, Joanna Russ, Ursula Le Guin, they were all very influential on me as I was coming up. I retain moments of their fiction just in my memory. There are just so many, many more.
Un auteur, par exemple, comme Zelazny, qui utilise énormément la thématique de l'immortalité, je pense, vous a énormément influencé.
Mm-hmm. Oui, et il me semble que Knight's Move, un livre que pas encore publié en France, m'a fait furieusement penser à Zelazny également.
I think that book was a result that was a 60s science fiction novel. I wrote that in part because I became a science fiction novel writer unexpectedly. And I hadn't intended to do that. And my reading was 10 years behind. And so I wrote a 60s science fiction novel because I didn't know what else had been going on since the 60s, I think. Zelazny is an influence, and Samuel R. Delaney is an enormous influence. Between the two of them are very interesting. They were both very influential on Kablai, I think. Zelazny for his poetic vision, Delaney for the way that he dealt with the underworld and the underclass, and his sort of way of dealing with those who have been left out. He writes about underworlds and undergrounds brilliantly.
Une question que j'aimerais vous poser, c'est comment faites-vous pour écrire tous les jours? Quelque chose, on va passer un peu dans le domaine de la pratique littéraire. Comment vous organisez pour écrire?
I'm a very physical writer, and I don't just sit at my desk and for hours on end without moving. I get a lot of inspiration from music. I'm always playing. My wife is always complaining about the music that I'm playing very loud, because I spend some time dancing. I jump up and down. I do exercises. I do martial arts. Anything to get my blood flowing.
Très physique, donc.
And then once I've worked myself into an appropriate frenzy, I run to the computer and I write very fast for a brief interval, and then I have to do it all over again. I dread someone planting a video camera in my workspace, because I would just hate to have to view myself doing any of that. No, you better not.
En tout cas, pour le public, je vous conseille de jeter un coup d'œil sur le blog, que je trouve vraiment très bien fait.
Oui, parce que Walter John Williams donc, maintient un blog de façon régulière. Il me semble même qu'il est écrit tous les jours. Et une question me vient à l'esprit, c'est... j'ai la sensation que vous n'avez pas toujours très envie d'écrire votre... De nous donner votre pain quotidien. Est-ce que c'est une envie profonde, ou est-ce que vous n'avez l'édition américaine vous laisse plus le choix aujourd'hui?
Well, the publishers do want you to have a blog. More and more of the job of promoting your book is falling on the writer. Now.
C'est moins cher.
Yeah, cutbacks in the publishing industry and so on. So we are all encouraged to have blogs, and we are all encouraged to be on Twitter, and we are all encouraged to be on Facebook and so forth. I enjoy blogging, but I don't have enough time for it. And there's only a certain amount of writing I can do in a given day. And if I write a long, intelligent, intensive essay on my blog, that means I'm probably not going to be writing a lot of fiction that day. And fiction is what I actually get paid for writing. So very often my blog just has trivial little things. I point to amusing videos, or if somebody else is being particularly profound on that day, I'll point the reader to that, or news items. But occasionally I will get myself together and I will write an essay on writing, or on something I have read, or on something I've seen on television or in the cinema.
Vous avez fait un peu d'enseignement aussi sur l'écriture.
Yes, I have taught the Clarion Writers Workshop, which is the oldest workshop in the States devoted to teaching the writing of fantasy and science fiction. And I have also started my own workshop, actually two workshops. I have a workshop in the summer in the mountains of New Mexico, for my peers. It's my writer friends that I want to spend a week in the mountains with. And we critique each other's work, and we cook. And that's one of the kind of unique aspects is that there is a lot of excellent gourmet cooking happening at this workshop, and I don't know how that came about. People were actually paying me to come to the mountains and cook for me.
Le rêve.
I'm just so delighted that this happened. But I also run a workshop called Tao's Toolbox, which is a master class in science fiction and fantasy. It's intended for people who have already published a little bit, or who have been to one of the other workshops and want to reconnect with the workshop experience. Actually, last year I had a student who was a Hugo-winning writer, which was quite a surprise for me, but it was also very flattering. I'm doing another one of those next year. If you're interested in writing science fiction, please apply. It's called Tao's Toolbox. The website is www.taostoolbox.com. I will be teaching together with Nancy Kress, who is a fantastic teacher, and also with Carrie Vaughn, who will deliver a special lecture. So that should be a really interesting experience.
Il me semble, personnellement, que vos livres sont caractérisés par le fait qu'ils sont extraordinairement abordables, tout en n'esquivant pas des sujets qu'on peut considérer et qui ont été traités ailleurs de façon beaucoup plus ardue. Mais il me semble que vous n'avez pas touché le grand public aux États-Unis. Mais il me semble que vous avez fait un essai assez récemment en décrivant l'arrivée du grand tremblement de terre que tous les Californiens attendent. Et j'aimerais bien que vous me parliez un peu des dessous éditoriaux de cette affaire.
Actually, can you be a little more specific? I'm not. Are you talking about the rift?
Yes.
The rift. Yeah. One of the things that kind of surprised me. This is some years ago now, but I was with traveling across Texas with a friend who mentioned that he in turn had a friend who was a geologist who was doing work on earthquake faults in the central U.S. And it turns out that the world's most dangerous earthquake fault is right in the center of the United States. It's called the New Madrid Fault, and it's underneath the Mississippi River. And it is last went off in 1811 and goes off regularly every couple hundred years. And it was an enormously destructive earthquake the last time it struck. But in 1811, there were only about 5,000 people of European descent in that area. Now there are close to 50 million, and none of them are prepared for the earthquake. My friend also told me that there had been tidal waves on the Ohio River. His friend had found the high water mark. And I thought this was a terrific opportunity for a novel that no one had done before. I'm always very interested in bridging the gap between my science fiction audience and between the general reading public, and this struck me as something that would work rather well as a crossover book. So I did a near-future exploration of that enormous earthquake. It's called The Rift, which also has a kind of metaphorical meaning. It's not just about the rift that comes with the earthquake. It's about the rifts in society that can be exposed by a catastrophe like that. I was a large part of the novel has to do with the question of black-white relations in the southern Mississippi Valley. And unfortunately, this was another one where I proved to be too good a prophet. Basically, in my novel, there are atrocious racist acts committed by some evil people. But when Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans, nobody set out to kill those people, but nobody set out to rescue them either. It was sort of the default reaction of the entire establishment, including the black establishment, that we're going to kill 8,000 people here now, and most of them are going to be black, and we're just not going to talk about any of that. And I was just watching television the night when the levee failed in New Orleans, and I've been to New Orleans often, and I know that country, and they said that the industrial canal has been breached, and I went, my God, New Orleans is done. Because I know that area. I've lived in that area. And the utter inability of, every organ of government to rescue those people was just a horrifying march through stuff that I had already envisioned. And I don't like being that kind of prophet at all.
Qu'est-ce qu'a donné votre cette tentative d'atteindre le grand public au niveau des États-Unis?
Well, unfortunately, that was destroyed by the publisher. There were internal wars going on at the publisher, at the American publisher. My editor, there were some people who wanted to fire my editor. They needed an excuse to fire my editor, and so they made sure that The Rift failed commercially, failed quite dismally. Then they were able to say that my editor had paid me a lot of money for this book that had failed and therefore had an excuse to fire him. And they not only fired him, but they canceled the entire science fiction line, which is the reason why none of you have seen the sequel to Plasma and Guerre de Plasma, because that was the same science fiction line that published The Rift. I sent many maledictions to New York, but I don't think they responded.
Il nous reste maintenant quelques minutes. Si dans le public quelqu'un parmi vous veut poser des questions, Norman.
I would like to know what publisher that was, so they could be excoriated in public as they well deserve.
It was HarperCollins, but HarperCollins is a different bunch of people now.
Not for very long, but okay. Yeah.
Si vous avez d'autres questions, n'hésitez pas.
Venez de votre premier texte.
I think it was left on the walls of my mother's womb. Actually, I don't. No. I think perhaps fortunately for my dignity, I think most of those have been destroyed.
Bonjour. J'ai lu Câblé au début des années 90. Vous étiez associé à la génération cyberpunk. Aujourd'hui, avec le déploiement d'Internet, qu'en est-il maintenant de cette génération cyberpunk?
Well, I think cyberpunk has evolved. It's still here. It's just not quite as recognizable. I think one of there were several points to cyberpunk that can be applied across the board to a lot of science fiction. One of them was that the future is not going to be just one culture, that there's going to be many cultures carried into the future. It isn't going to be the standard people in jumpsuits and silver boots walking down steel corridors, that the world is going to be made up of many different cultures and many different subcultures that are all going to be using the technology in different ways. And that is the other lesson of cyberpunk. which is that the technology will be adapted by every cultural niche in a different way. And I think now we're seeing that all around us.
John Williams, je vous remercie sincèrement. Et on vous retrouve de suite donc sur le plateau librairie pour une séance de rencontre avec le public. Merci beaucoup.
Right, thank you all. And thank you.